What's up, everybody? David Pollack here of See Ball, Get Ball podcast. I hope you like it, man. Be sure to follow the show wherever you subscribe, YouTube, or any of your other platforms. All right, welcome into See Ball, Get Ball. I'm your host, David Pollack. Brent Rollins joining me as always. Brent, we talked about Trump several times and the administrative plan. We're not talking about politics here. This is college football, okay? Don't
definitely chill, not doing that.
Relax. But like how he was talking with Saban about intervening. Now we got some more of this with the governor of Tennessee, Governor Bill Lee, trying to the way I look at it is trying to kind of go around the agreement that was being – I mean, that's the way I look at it, Brent. You tell me if you look at it differently. Brent is a lot smarter than I am, but, like, it seems like he wants to go around the agreement of what college football has kind of tried to put in place, where you're trying to kind of put rules and guardrails to govern it a little bit better, but now – this guy's like, nah, wait a minute. You want to be able to sue so you can have full access, you know, not have a salary cap, basically. Is that how about you were reading it, my man?
It's all to give some backdrop first. So this was, I think it was May 1st was when that was the Tennessee thing was signed. It's kind of very silently. And then Ross Dellinger in his weekly Ross Dellinger State of College Football, you know, article that he puts out now, because it is a weekly thing, talked about how the power conferences are working to kind of put these schools together. And the reason it says on the screen, a new NCAA, is kind of, that's what maybe they're in essence trying to create because of what the Tennessee law did, which was say, hey, you can basically not be penalized. I think it's just remove, you can do whatever you want and not be penalized by this new agreement. And the power conferences are like, wait, hold on a second. Nope. We need enforcement. We don't want this. If this is going to happen, it's going to happen with enforcement. It's going to happen where people need to stay within the rules. And then they're talking about, hey, let's, you know, this by the title of the article, by the way, power conferences on Yahoo Sports working to on contract to bind schools to new enforcement rules with strict punishments. It's basically, so stuff like that doesn't exist, but this gets into a legal realm that instantly becomes, I mean, I deal with, in a side job, by the way, I deal with attorneys. I do work and on the side as an expert witness in my day job. This is still a whole other world for me.
Brent is a man of many talents. I mean, he's a professor. He's a football numbers guru with Rivals, with PFF. He works on the side with lawyers. He goes on the stand and does all kinds of cool things. Here's my thing, Brent. The governor doesn't matter in the end. Like, he's not going to change this, I don't think. What I think is going to happen is I think the conferences are going to band together. They're going to try to implement this rule, because every coach you talk to in college football, almost every coach, let me rephrase that, there are a few that have unlimited budgets that would be more than willing to not have guardrails and yeah, or to not have a salary cap. There's a few schools that would be all for that. Very, very few. But here's what all these coaches I keep talking to are super excited about, man. It's the enforcement arm that changes college football. Like, that's what they're excited about, because these rules don't mean anything if the sanctions become a, oh, please don't do that again, bro. Like, yeah, we didn't like that. Like, you're talking about when you go over the salary cap by $1 million, you're going to get fined $1 million. You're going to miss out now on future money to be able to spend, because they will take that ability away from you. They'll limit your pool to spend. They're also going to say, hey, you can't go in the transfer portal now for X, for Y. Like, this is not like just a, hey, you know, you're going to get a slap on the wrist. Like, this will be, if this enforcement arm comes to fruition, coaches can get suspended. Like, this is a big deal, and this is the way, man. If you're a fan of changing college football and not having the Wild Wild West, Governor of Tennessee Bill Lee wants the Wild Wild West for the state of Tennessee. So be it. You don't want that as a college. I don't want that as a college football fan. Like, I want the college sport. I want there to be rules. I want there to be guardrails. I don't want this to be a, I'm going wherever I want to go, when I want to go. That's not what I want. That's not what I love about the sport, and that's not where I would like to get to. And so this is direct competition with that in the NCAA to me.
Yep, very much so. And like you said, with coaches and most coaches, they're like, give me the parameters. I'll work within the parameters and I'll go to work and coach ball and do that. Just give me the parameters. That's all they want. But I think the biggest thing with this, and this is one thing that I definitively know from working with attorneys, billable hours are always undefeated.
Gats to pay to play. Gats to like, do it. No doubt.
There will be lawsuits. There will be stuff, all that sort of stuff. And that continues until there's like real work. When there's real work that needs to be done, i.e. trial, then things, well, let's settle.
And Brent, here's the last component of me that if you're a college football fan like us, like we're all in this, man, because we want the sport to be great and we want to grow and get better and get it back to some semblance of normalcy. I would say again, a normal where everybody's playing the same game. That's what I'm saying. I want everybody to be able to have the opportunity to be successful. And you could argue that wasn't always the case and it's not always the case. And so be it. Yes. But here's the thing. You've got this new cap. I have already heard now a number, and this is what I'm interested to see moving forward. So every school is going to be able to allocate their salary cap as they choose. So for example, I'm interested to see what Kansas's is. Like how much of Kansas's budget goes to basketball versus football. If I'm from Kansas, Rock Chalk Jayhawk, baby, like I want to put a lot towards basketball because I'm a perennial power there. Kentucky, like what is that going to be with this salary cap? So I'll give you an example. I can tell you what Georgia's is. What do you think it is, Brent? Just guess. What do you think the numbers are? Because I think you'll be pretty dang close.
I mean, 2/3 football, 1/3 everything else.
80% goes to football. So 80% of their, remember the new rules, it's like 20.5% or 20.5 million you have of your new salary cap money you can spend. So 80% is going to go to Georgia. 15% is going to men's hoops. Because guess what? It's football and it's men's hoops. Those are the two sports in college football that make money. Yep. Nothing else makes money. But I didn't say I didn't like the other sports, Brent. I didn't say that they don't have relevancy. My daughter plays basketball. I'd love to have her opportunity to play college basketball. That's awesome. You know what the other sports get? 5%. Divvy it up amongst the 5%. So, like, this is the world you're living in where everybody talks about, like, I want these players to be paid. I do. I want them to be paid. But there's also all these things that come with it. And are we paying them, like we talked about last time, are we paying them and putting them on scholarships still? Or can some of that money go to other programs to help fund those programs? Because we're hurting the other programs. Whether you like it or not, like, they're going to suffer because of the decisions we make. But anyways, I digress.
Speaking of decisions, and then we'll get to our guest here in just a second. USC, Notre Dame, they've got this year on the books. After that, USC's offered one more year to basically be able to play at home. And then after that, it's not a guaranteed deal. It's looking more so like this might go away. This is on the brink of us talking about Notre Dame and Clemson having a long deal. This doesn't shock me at all. USC's in the Big Ten now. They got to worry about playing the Big Ten. It's as nice and as much their fans love the rivalry. That's another possible L in their schedule. And you got to take care of that business. Notre Dame, of course they want to play it because they need it. They need it for their schedule to look relevant in a way.
It's so, definitely, but anyway, more
thoughts on this.
It's a more important game for Notre Dame, obviously, because yes, they're independent, having a team to schedule. But this is exactly what the last one, the changes of college football, that like we started this show, this is what we continue to lose. We continue to lose rivalries. We continue to lose things that you grew up watching that you absolutely loved, that you want to see more of, because it doesn't make sense. Like how many rivalries have we lost along the way because of that? Like that's the cost of doing business, and that's going to continue to be the cost of doing business moving forward, because nobody cares about rivalries. They care about, is the game continuing to make more money, to bring in more people to watch, more advertising? Now, listen, we still love it. I still love it. But this is another casualty, like you've seen with Oklahoma, Oklahoma State, with Bedlam, right? And plenty of other rivalries that we talked about a couple weeks ago. All right, excited about the next guy, Coach Dan Casey. Brent, we are all too familiar with Coach Dan Casey. And we have been sending plays back and forth like, hey, I think we can run this in youth league football. Shoot, I guess we started when they were – probably around 8 or 9, right?
Nine,
like
10, yeah, nine, I mean, 10.
So yeah. you're talking 10 years ago for Carson Rollins. And so, Dan, that's how long we've been fans and we've been following you and the evolution. Now the Play Callers Club, because you got swag now. Look at that.
You got swag, man. We're doing this thing.
How long have you been doing the plays of the week, and just how long have you been diving? I know you've been a high school football coach, but how long have you been diving into all this stuff, and how many years now?
Yeah, man, you're probably just about right on there, like 9 or 10 years. Was a high school coach, pretty much fresh out of college, and was just desperate to talk ball with anyone who would listen. And unfortunately, my first coaching job, I didn't have anybody else on campus who was coaching football with me at the varsity level at the time. So I was just reaching out to anyone and everyone, and started posting on Twitter back when it was Twitter. And man, it just grew and grew. And I got connected with so many amazing people, including both of you guys over the years. And it's been a blast, man. It's been so much fun to just digest as much football as possible and share it out there to the world.
All right. So if somebody follows Coach Dan Casey, if you realize this, you're going to get so many plays, and you're going to see so many things and kind of why they work. And then you'll break them down in more detail too. Like, who are you watching? You know what? Better than that, before we get to who you're watching, because I want to ask you that question. Like, college football, offense in college football, where is it going? Where do you think the next evolution is, or what do you think is going to be more prevalent this next season?
It's a great question. I think everything's in flux. I know you guys were just talking about some NIL stuff and trying to figure everything out. Obviously, the game is trending more professional at the highest level. So you do have kind of this chasm, right, of the Power Four, especially the Big Ten and the SEC, are starting to look more like the NFL, whereas some of the lower level schools, they get lost in the wash a little bit. FCS, they're still doing some really cool stuff in FCS, Big Sky Conference and different things like that. But I would say, if you're casually consuming football on the weekends, if you're a fan and you're watching a lot of SEC and Big 12, Big 10 rather, and Big 12 as well, you're seeing a lot more pro style stuff. So it's starting to leak into it. And the challenge that a lot of these coaches are facing is that you don't have as much time as you used to install your offenses and get everything figured out. Rosters are turning over like crazy every year. And so you really do have to simplify a lot of things. And so that's the challenge. How do you get in what you want with the players you have? And that's the creative challenge every week that these guys are facing.
I see volume one in the background. That would be the trends in offensive football. Yeah, right, so there. I think Davey's, the blue book there. Davey's question almost gets to the book that's now, I think it's now out, right? You can
Go. Trends volume two,
baby.
Volume two.
We're ready.
What's one? Just everybody's going to go buy the book, by the way. They need to go buy the book because, they should. And if you care about football at all, and coaches around the world do this, but what's maybe one that you think from there that kind of gets to what he's talking about?
Yeah. I mean, I think a general theme that kind of came out of volume two and just consuming a ton of football throughout the course of the season was bigger personnel grouping. So you're seeing a lot more two tight end sets in offense throughout college football and the NFL. You're usually seeing teams play with a bigger tight end who's kind of on the ball and then kind of a flex move tight end. I mean, Brock Bowers is like the quintessential example, right, of somebody who can be a move piece in your offense. I think Sean Payton calls it a joker, somebody that can create matchup problems for you and still do a lot of the run game stuff you want to do at the pro level. So I would say it's hard to pick one specific play, but I think the trend that you're seeing more than anything is, all right, how do we get two tight end bodies on the field? How do we recruit these guys off the basketball court to come play tight end for us and convince them to, instead of rebounding, go rebound in the end zone and be a red zone threat for us. I think high school coaches are doing it. College coaches are doing it. It's prevalent in the NFL, obviously. I would say if there's one thing you can pull out, it's bigger personnel groupings trying to create mismatches because defenses are having to play smaller to match up with some of the spread stuff. So, yeah, 12 personnel, man. You're gonna see a ton of it at all levels of football, I would say.
Well, and that's what you said right there at the end is the other side of the coin. Like, that as a defense, man, you make me make a decision. Like, right. It's very simple. It's very easy to watch. It's very easy to see. All you got to do is see their personnel. Like, do they want to put a bigger body in there? If they do, then I can take advantage of them maybe in the passing game. Do they want to put a smaller body in there? Now that move tight end is still way bigger than he is. Like, way bigger. So it kind of puts you obviously, you know, in a bind. When you were putting together the book and you were watching all the tape, like who were some of the play callers that you stood out to you from a field standpoint, or just like, man, I just like the way they call the game. I like the way they set things up or whatever. What caught your eye?
Yeah, you know, to be honest with you, I thought the Big Ten was fantastic this past season. Obviously, you have Chip Kelly, who everybody thinks of Chip Kelly, and they think back to kind of his early Oregon days and when he was with the Philadelphia Eagles, maybe a little bit more 10 personnel, so that's one running back, no tight ends, maybe 11 some as well, one running back, one tight end. But Chip Kelly did some really fun stuff this past year at Ohio State, and you can kind of see the evolution of him. He did it at UCLA. It just obviously wasn't on as big of a national stage, but bigger personnel groupings.
Better players helped.
Better players always help. And even what he was doing a little bit with Egbuka, the receiver, and Jeremiah Smith, and almost putting them in the tight end role a little bit, which really creates some matchup problems. So I think Chip did an amazing job, and obviously he'll be with the Raiders this next season. But then you see Penn State, Andy Kotelnicki, really doing a great job getting his tight end involved, snapping him the ball, Tyler Warren, running basically QB counter with a tight end, doing a lot of shifts and motions. He does an excellent job. And then Will Stein at Oregon does such a great job of marrying the run and the pass, using unbalanced formations. His pass game is very kind of pro style. I think I really, really enjoyed watching the Big Ten this past year. Because you're starting to see it form kind of its own identity when you mix in the West Coast crowd with kind of Midwestern, meat and potatoes football. It was a fun mix this past season. So I really enjoyed it.
Hold on, I want to get back to, because you're a nerd. We're nerds. We get it. We understand.
Totally.
But like unbalanced. Like,
okay, explain, great.
No. But just explain to people out there what that means, because I think that we obviously know what it means when you coach and when you've been around it, but like,
sure,
how you get an advantage by basically using numbers and what that means.
100%. Yeah. So there's two ways you can get in an unbalanced formation. You can either take your line of scrimmage, you got your tackles, your guards, and your center, and you can just take one of those tackles and move them to the other side of the ball. So tackle over. You see that a lot in the NFL. Todd Monken loves doing that in Baltimore with the Ravens, especially in the red zone. Cliff Kingsbury really brought it in this past season. They did a ton of unbalanced with the Commanders in Washington, making things a little easier on Jaden Daniels. And in the college level, what you see more often is they'll keep the offensive line structure the same. You're going to have your tackles, your guards, and your center, and they're just going to bring essentially like one of the eligible receivers to a different part of the formation and cover them up. So it's just, it gives the defense something that they need to identify pre-snap. So, hey, who's eligible? Who's allowed to go out for a pass here? Creates a little bit of confusion before the snap. And especially if you're playing with any sort of tempo, like you're moving fast between play calls, a lot of times you can get something cheap.
And coach, that would be the definition right there of what you're talking about. Brent, you're asking the next question. I just want to say this. See ball, get ball. That's exactly what this show's about, coach. I'm a defensive guy. We do not think that much, bro. We are ball snapped, ball moved, go get it. So when you 100%. Shift more people over here and you hide somebody that's not eligible, which means somebody outside of him is on the line of scrimmage.
Correct. Yep.
A lot of times we are so dumb that we don't even see it. And I'm not kidding. Like, and they'll absolutely cover it unless you're really smart and you're able to communicate, pass along information. So you make defenses communicate 100%. And think more. And when you slow us down, we don't do a good a job, Brent, as see ball, get ball.
Well, I think to your point real quick, see ball, get ball. I knew I was jumping on a defensive guy podcast when I saw that name and I was like, oh boy, I don't know if they're going to like me too much. But to your point about communication, especially before the snap, there's a great quote from Ed Reed when he was in Baltimore, and he just said, what made us great as a defense is the amount of communication that happened before the snap. Like, there was never a moment where we weren't talking on defense. And I've heard coaches say over the years, you hear a good defense before you see it. Kirby, I think, is a great example of that. Like, the amount of chatter that you hear, especially when you go to a practice, it's nonstop communication. And if you can throw a wrench in that communication as an offensive coach, it's an advantage for you. And that's why you're seeing shifts, motions, and unbalanced stuff.
Yeah, Georgia actually is doing a lot of the unbalanced with receivers and covering up the tight end and trying to bubble fake, take deep shots off of that, use it in the running game, all those sort of things. So who's a team maybe that's not in the mainstream that you watch? Maybe group of five. Like, for me, when watching Navy this year was just a glorious, if you love offensive football in terms of the running game
100%. And love
designing of the running game, Navy was so much fun to watch. So who's some of those
love
off the wall
triple
teams?
Option.
Yeah, you're hitting a nerve right here, man. Man, Navy's so much fun. Army is different, also fun, in a more brute force kind of way. I'm just going to go in on Navy real quick, and then I'll pivot somewhere else. But Navy was so fun. Drew Cronick was the offensive coordinator this past season. He had come up actually from the FCS level. He was at Mercer. Before that, he was at Lenoir Ryan, a D2 school in North Carolina that used to beat up on me when I played in college. And, you know, one of the cool things about Coach Cronick is, yes, they're running some triple option, but really his roots, his DNA is the wing T. This goes, you know, if you've ever played football back in the day, like every youth coach in America was probably running some version of the wing T, a lot of misdirection, motion, some fun stuff like that. And I thought Navy just did a great job of putting together a system that had a little bit of option, had a little bit of wing T, had some really cool pass game stuff. And that's, I think, more than anything, what you're seeing is a lot of these like old school offenses are coming back around. Football, we always talk about football being cyclical, that things go out of fashion and come back into fashion. And the wing T is certainly something that I expect to see a lot more of. And even at the NFL level, like you saw Liam Cohen with the Buccaneers, like they would always run these little spinner trap plays with Bucky Irving. And that's wing T. I mean, Liam Cohen grew up playing for his dad in high school, was a wing T coach. You're seeing some of these systems filter into the highest levels of football. But when it comes down to me for like, just if I want to turn on a game just to enjoy watching it, this may be a little bit off the beaten path, but UC Davis, an FCS school in the Big Sky Conference, their head coach, Tim Plow, has been there for a long time previously as the offensive coordinator. He played there, went to Boise State for a little bit and came back to UC Davis. And, I just love the way that they move the quarterback around with boot concepts, and we call them dash concepts. So basically the idea is that the quarterback drops back to pass, but the whole plan is for him to escape the pocket and get out on the edge a little bit and make throws. And they actually have a running back kid named Lan Larrison who signed with the Patriots, who I think he's going to play in the NFL for a long time. I think he's a really talented kid, but they did such a good job moving him around, utilizing him in different ways. And so, for me as a football nerd, I don't really care so much about the level you play at. It's like, is it good ball or not? And I think a lot of the good coaches that I've talked to, you talk about Chip Kelly, like he doesn't care where the idea comes from. If it's a good idea, he's going to take it. Cliff Kingsbury is the same way. Some of the best offensive minds, I think, in my opinion, they're more football theorists than they are. This is my system and I know best. They're pulling in ideas from all over the place. And that's why I think it's, right now is such a fun time to be involved in offensive football, because there's so many ideas coming from so many different places and guys are putting them together in a really creative way.
And coming from you, by the way, a lot of it is coming from you and the sort of short clips and the use of social media to grow that to where a whole host of coaches, whether that be at those levels that we're talking about right now or at the youth football levels that we did or at high school levels, they're all using that and seeing, oh, I can blend that with what I do by this one little thing, but this because you've made it visible.
Well, I've just tried to shine a light on it. Honestly, I mean, there's so much good football out there that if you study it and if you dig deep, the only problem is during the season, coaches don't have time. So I think they kind of maybe use me at times as a shortcut of like, hey, I don't have time to watch all this, but you know, is there anything cool that came out of FCS this week? Okay, cool. We can throw that in there. So it's a ton of fun, man. I get to have some really cool conversations throughout the week of just what different guys are going to try. And it's fun to see it show up on game day.
Well, and you say like, you know, old school kind of coming back, but you also, that's what big personnel was too back in the day. So that's
very true.
That's coming back in the cyclical nature. What do you, when you're a play caller and you're going like, give me a coaching perspective, and remember, keep this simple for people that aren't
for sure,
you know, play callers and smart, like just, when you see a defense, like, and you're trying to attack a defense, like, what is the first thing you're watching? How do you find advantages? Like, what's the thought process as a play caller?
That's a great question. I think there's two iterations when you're a play caller. The first thing you're looking for is, what are some ways that you can attack the structure? So the structure of the defense would be like, are we in a four down front? Are we in an an odd three down front? And what are some plays that we have that kind of go best against the structure of the defense? And structure is you have your front structure and then you have your coverage structure. You know, if a team is going to play primarily cover three, we have plays that we like against cover three, plays that we like against cover four, cover two. You know, there's so many different
plays that you already run. That exactly. You're very comfortable doing, that you play, that you run every week, that those are your staples.
Your staples. You're always going to have your staples. And then the second iteration of that is, how can we isolate and take advantage of the weakest link on the defense? So obviously every structure, right? Every, and if you're an engineer, right? Like every time you have a building, you're going to have these stress points that you really have to make sure that you're ensuring over and over again. And from an offensive perspective, it's like, all right, how do we find a weak point and continue to hammer home at that? Unfortunately, it's usually one player that gets picked on quite a bit, whether it's in the pass game or the run game. So I think, yeah, you have this twofold preparation process of, one, how do we attack the structure? Two, how do we attack a weak point within the structure? So that's usually when you get those game plan elements of like, oh, they're running this specific play against this team, and it's probably because they have a freshman corner out there or something like that. So those are the things you're looking at.
You use the term love language, Davey. I'm that's speaking my love language right there. Football is a weak link system. 100%. Offensive line play, secondary play, those two to me specifically where, hey, who's the weak link? How do I attack that individual and make them sort of get exposed? All right, so what's maybe off of that? Do you ever see the I formation coming back as a thing? Two tight ends, I formation, like true old school football. Do you ever see that coming back?
100%.
No.
You'll probably see it this season.
Under center. I formation? No.
Yes, you will. Because at the end of the day, like, for example, an ISO or a lead draw, that's where you have a fullback leading on a linebacker for a running back. And a lot of these linebackers, especially like maybe a Will linebacker, right? His body type is designed
to be
in coverage, right? I mean, he's 218 when he used to be 255. And so would you want that guy taken on? An example would be Patrick Ricard, right? From the Baltimore Ravens. Ooh. He's a fullback who's 305.
Three bills. I mean,
he's a tank.
Yeah, he's three bills.
And you know, you're seeing some of that stuff show up where it's body blows, right? And if you can inflict body blows on a defense, you're creating an advantage for yourself. And that can come in a variety of ways, but you will absolutely see some I formation this season.
The only thing I would say to counter that is, the thing about, and listen, I played college ball in I formation. So like, I get it. The only thing I'll say is it just becomes very, very easy to read. Like, yes. It's just offenses now, dude. It's like playing the magic hat game. Like that game they put on the built on the screens where they're moving the ball around, like in this hat, and you're just trying to figure it out. And
for sure.
I mean, you get an I formation, you can get creative, but you're going to follow the fullback a lot. Like that is your main guy. And now with the ability, like with all these jokers that you're pulling it and bringing them across the formation and having so much flexibility, that's where I would say it'd be interesting to see if you want to go back. And you're right. The body types are way different. Like, and I think the toughness, Dan, is different. I don't think you have as many guys that grew up wanting to hit that are physical. You got a lot of guys that like to play 7-on-7 that, hey, I'll go cover.
No doubt.
But I'm not sticking my face in the fan.
Right, right. Well, no, I think to a certain extent, you're correct in the sense that, like, from a structural standpoint, the I formation does give you keys to read as a defensive player. Now, here's where offensive guys will break the mold a little bit, right? So take Jeff Brohm, for example, at Louisville. He'll get in 12 personnel, and it'll be kind of your standard tight end on the ball, tight end off the ball. And then he'll step the quarterback up under center, motion one of the tight ends into the backfield to be in the I formation, run a play fake, and send that fullback on like a 18-yard sail route matched up on a linebacker. Like, good luck, right? You're seeing ISO, then you're seeing all of a sudden taking downfield shots with a fullback who's really just your joker tight end playing fullback. So I think it's one of those, it's a cat and mouse game, right? Of like, okay, how are we going to handle the run game elements of that? How do we add in pass game elements? So I think it's one of those things. I don't think it's going to be a primary offense. Like, I don't think you're going to see people bringing back Nebraska's I formation option that they used to run with Tom Osborne.
Tommy Frazier.
It was great stuff, man. It's great stuff. But I don't think you're going to see that so much. But I do think you're going to see it used situationally to create curveball. So, yeah, I would say more so curveball stuff.
Well, and you see, like you see with basketball, man, like, you know, people throw in the zone and like, okay, can you beat it?
Totally.
And if you can't beat it, then okay, I'm going to keep running it, right? Like, right. I think right. I love that as a counter to, you know, you throw that in there occasionally and okay, you don't have a plan for that. If you don't have a plan for that, you're screwed. Okay.
Get ready.
I'll line up in I formation the whole time. What about shot plays? What about like, how do you decide? Like you got all these, I've seen it. You've got a million gadget plays / trick plays. Like what about play calling and when you want to call those or how you design those?
No, that's a great question. I think every coach philosophically has to determine how they want to handle quote unquote trick plays. I actually hate the term trick plays because it puts an undue amount of pressure on the play to gain a certain amount of yardage for it to be considered a success. I actually don't think in those terms at all. And this goes back to like Bill Walsh when he was coaching with Paul Brown with the Cincinnati Bengals. Paul Brown had a philosophy that was, if you have a trick, use it before the other guy does. So it was always this kind of, hey, we're going to put stuff on film. We've got plenty of ideas. We don't need to be afraid of anything. We're going to run trick plays early and often. And so Bill Walsh always did that, having lots of tricks up his sleeve. Ben Johnson with the Lions, he has the famous
so quote, good.
The bag is deep.
So good.
Yeah, like stumble, it's incredible.
The tight end stumble.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. And it's fun, right? It's fun for the players. And so instead of thinking of trick plays as this thing that's outside of your offensive system, trick plays are just a part of it now. And there's less pressure on them to specifically hit for a certain amount of yardage. It's just like, hey, we're going to put a ton of this crap on film and keep these defensive guys that are see ball, get ball up all night trying to figure out what we're going to do this week. And yeah, so I think when it comes to trick plays and shot plays, those are just thought of as like a special wrinkle as part of the offense, but not necessarily like the pressure on them to succeed is not the same way. You're not trying to hold them for the playoffs. You see some teams running flea flickers every game. Like they're literally running flea flickers every game. It's just their play action. So yeah, I mean, I think there's just less stress now on, hey, this is our trick play. If it doesn't hit for a touchdown, it's a failure.
So correct me if I'm wrong. I think you're sort of moved more into the consulting and everybody comes and asks me questions world versus calling plays as an offensive coordinator like you used to in
correct.
Texas.
Correct.
Yep. That's your world now. So when you were calling plays, did you call those the fun plays or did you use the word, hey, we got this trick play this week? Or did you just say, hey, we got a fun play this week?
Yeah, what I say is like, we got a special. We got something okay. special that's kind of a wrinkle. It doesn't put the same amount of like of pressure on it. And what I often did is like, I would try to give my guys that I was coaching an opportunity to bring things to me. And they would have kind of an initial idea and I would kind of workshop it to fit more in what we were doing. But I think that's something that, you know, I heard Andy Reid does a ton of just like allowing the players to be involved in that process and come up with ideas. And when you get players engaged, and what we'd always do is like, if you had the idea and we installed it, like that play was named after you, right? So yeah. It's just a fun way to like keep the players involved. I just think that coaching, like when I grew up, it was like, yes, sir, no, sir. That like coach was coach, right? And I think what I've started to view it more of now and just with talking to guys at the highest level is viewing coaching as a partnership with your players, not so much kind of this hierarchical top-down thing. And so I think the specials or kind of the trick plays, if you want to call them that, are a way that you can engage with your guys, get them involved in the process, make it fun, and not feel like it's kind of a dictator type situation. It's a partnership.
It's a game. It's a game
and it's fun.
It's supposed to be fun. Like that's, and the guy above me here is always preaching that. All right. So 100%. Given that you're in this kind of consulting realm now where teams all across the country are talking to you all the time, is it now a weekly thing where you see a conversation and an idea that you've thrown out to someone actually get played out on the field on Saturday or Sunday?
Yeah, it's probably every week. And I try to watch everything too. So to the best of my ability. So that's cool. I will say it's not the same though as when you install something for someone, for a player, like when I was coaching high school, for a player that you see every day and have watched him develop and grow into the athlete that he is now. And the amount of joy that you get from that, I think, is greater. But this is kind of a cool season of my life professionally that I get to kind of spread my tentacles all over the place and help guys. So I almost feel more like I'm partnering with the coaches now, whereas before I was partnering with the players. So it's unique for sure, but it's always fun to see those things show up on film.
Okay, so I have to use your verbiage because you're our guest. The special plays, the specials, when you talk about across the country, the different guys that call them, the timing, the guy you already mentioned, Braum, comes to mind for me. Like, yes. That dude just,
100%.
I swear to goodness, like calling his games, I'm always like, it's coming. It's just a matter of when, and he's got a knack, and he just, it seems to work always. It just seems like he knows when to call it, how to call it. Like, who are the guys you're watching that you see just are really good at that or have that knack?
So this is going to take me in a direction of like an analogy I like to use with guys. I think whenever I'm studying a play caller, I will try to categorize them in one of two buckets. I think on one hand, you have classical musicians, your Mozarts, who like to have everything on paper, who like to script everything out, are really detail-oriented, analytical, will use analytics, like are really kind of like that's their mindset. And on the other hand, you have kind of your jazz musicians, right? Where they like to have a little bit more feel to what they're doing, more intuitive in their play calling. If they, you know, they're going to feel the game, they're usually going to call it from the sideline. And they kind of have an intuition around when to call something, when to hold back. And so I think you have these two buckets of personality types when it comes to offensive coaches. And I think that typically the guys that are a little bit jazzier are the ones that put a little bit less pressure on themselves for those plays to be perfect every time and will call it a little bit more. But I think some of the best guys, period, are the ones that can combine a little bit of that. They have the organization and the discipline of a classical musician and a little bit of the free art of jazz. So I always like to use that analogy. And so I think you kind of have to ask the person, is this an analytics based decision that you decided to call this because you were in the right spot on the field with your right game state? Or was this like, hey, I just feel like this play is about to pop. Let's call it. Let's let it rip.
Who's an NFL example of each category?
Okay. That's going to be great. That's a great question. So I would say from like a maybe more classical sense, like you're probably talking the Shanahan tree a little bit more. So like a Kyle Shanahan and some of the guys that have broken off of his tree, are going to typically be like, hey, everything's in for a reason and everything has an answer. We're going to get to the line. We're going to check out of things. We're going to, you know, do all of that. And then I think on the jazzier side, you probably have Cliff Kingsbury, who's got just a huge volume of stuff to pull from. And then he's one of the few guys in the NFL that will call the same play several times throughout the game. Like you actually don't see that a ton in the NFL of guys just calling the exact same play. And when you watch Cliff, it's like, oh, it's the same play because it worked. Why would we not call it again? So just kind of the intuition, letting it rip. I think Cliff's a great example of that. There are others for sure. And then a lot of the guys in the NFL are kind of on that spectrum. They're maybe not like all in on one direction or all in on the other. Mike Leach, right? Like that guy was letting it rip and trusting his guys
to make the right read. Don't give a dang. Yes,
not at all.
Yeah, but I tell you what though, man, the one thing I'll say about that is, When you play call like that, God, it stresses me out. Like as a defensive guy, because I love to have the tendencies and I love to have the normalcy. So it does. And here's another thing, like Buster Faulkner, when I watch him for Georgia Tech, he drives me batty. And again, I'm talking about as a defensive guy. I look at it through a defensive lens. You guys look at it through an offensive lens, because the blending of spread, of QB run, of all the different personnel group. Like, listen, you can't master all of that. Like, so when I find coaches that find a way to master a few plays from all the different areas and arenas, now I got to prepare for all of that crap and have a plan for it and be ready for it. And it's just, it's freaking frustrating.
So I know you guys are obviously probably a little more schooled in the Georgia coaching tree than I am, but he was at Georgia, right, with Kirby for a little while?
With Todd Monken.
He was with Monken. Okay. So yeah, you can see some of the similarities. It's almost like that offense at Georgia Tech was designed to give as many headaches to a Kirby Smart style defense as humanly possible with the amount
100%. Of hence why they've had success. Hence why they've had success against Georgia. Yes.
100%. Very much so. And anyone who's kind of coming at defense from the Saban Kirby Smart system, they're so detail oriented that the amount of communication that has to take place, like we're talking about, he's going to stress that every time. The shifts, the motions, the QB run game. I mean, literally, if you could construct a perfect offense to play against that defense, it's what Buster Faulkner put together at Georgia Tech.
I sent Dan a play that he had tweeted about from Georgia Tech. And it's like, hey, here, what about this off of that as your 2-point play? Like, I'm sure that's happens, by the way, daily now for you with coaches that you've interacted with all throughout the country, high school coaches especially, send you stuff. You sit like it's just a back and forth. I'm sure that those relationships are great. But one more passion for me, and I think you're starting to get into this a little bit and see more of it. I think it, especially with the way with NFL guys being allowed in flag football Olympics, I think it's going to be more of it.
Yeah.
How the 2 QB system. Are we going to see more of the 2 QB system, 2 QBs on the field at the same time? Because I have a whole library of stuff that I've saved on that specifically.
Oh, yeah, man. You're speaking my language right now. The 2 QB stuff is really fun. I think, I could go so many different directions with this, but the reality is when you want to talk about stressing a defense, having multiple throwers on the field at the same time. I won't call them passers, like reading the defense, but even go back to like when Mohamed Sanu was with the Falcons and who else did he play for? The Bengals.
Patriots.
I think he played for the Patriots as well. Just the threat of him throwing the football or doing some wildcat stuff was enough to force a defensive coordinator to spend all that time preparing. And so I think obviously you want at least one of those guys to be mobile to be able to do some of the QB run stuff. But the fact that you have multiple throwers on the field creates a ton of issues for defenses. And I think you're just going to see more and more of it show up because you're already in the NFL seeing more QB run game. Lamar's a great example. Jaden Daniels did an amazing job with it this past year. So they're already a bit of a threat in the run game. But then you add in another person on the field who can throw it. I thought Penn State did a really good job when they would bring the young guy Prabula in, who's now at – where is he now?
Missouri.
I'm trying to remember. Missouri. Right. He's going to do a good job for Kirby Moore there. He's dynamic, right? But then you have Aller split out wide. You could throw a lateral to him and he could throw it. I mean, they had so many different things that they could do. And again, the preparation cost for a defense to have to face two quarterbacks is steep for how much you may actually end up using that play. You maybe throw those two guys out there 2 or 3 times a game, but a defense is probably going to burn an entire day prepping for that. So it's definitely like worth the option. An offensive coach. 100%.
Like the option, man. Like we literally are going to spend a period a week if you play a triple option team for a season. Like
yes.
you're gonna spend five to 10 minutes because you have to understand the principles. If you don't, you're absolutely screwed. You're gonna lose. Like you're gonna get beat and you can't be successful. All right, coach, I think we would love to do this more often, man. During
absolutely,
the season,
man, I
think during the season, Dan, it'd be so great to just be like, what are you seeing in college football? Because I think you're so good at this stuff. Where do people find your stuff, man, if they want to get educated and learn more football?
Yeah, I try to put a ton of free stuff out there as much as I can on Twitter, Instagram. I'm kind of on all those platforms. But I would say probably the thing I enjoy doing most is the one play a day. It's a daily email I send out. Gives you a diagram and some visuals and just I think that's probably the most beneficial for people. If you search one play a day, you can sign up for that email list and get an email to start your day every morning, 5:29 a.m. Central, hits your inbox and you get to wake up with morning coffee and good football. It's can't beat that.
You go buy the new book. Go buy the new book.
There you go. Trends, baby. Trends and
offensive football. Volume 2.
Yeah, you get the play. If you're a fan that really loves college football and you want to understand more of what you're seeing, this is what Dan exists for. Like this is the it really is. It's the perfect blend to like learn what it means. And when you hear these terms, you're like, what the heck does unbalanced mean? Like now you can learn that. And then it would just blow your mind. Like we are big dumb animals on the field, but like to know what goes into every play and calling and this and the stuff that you can tag things with and just learn from, man. It's really, really cool. So appreciate your time, big fella. And we'll definitely get you back on, man.
Appreciate you guys.
Thanks, dude. Thanks, Coach.